Does it have to be human?
Beep, beep.
Does it have to be mine?
Beep, beep.
Where am I supposed to get it?
Feed me, Seymour. Feed me all night long.
That's right, boy.
You can do it. Feed me, Seymour. Feed me all night long.
Well, carnivorous plants are fascinating, even if they're not talking to us like Audrey 2 is talking to Seymour. They seem like a hybrid between plant and animal. And whether it's a tiny Venus flytrap that we care for as a kid or Audrey 2 in Little Shop of Horrors, they capture our imaginations. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Carnivorous plants seem so exotic, but there are actually many species that live in the U.S. and even right here in Wisconsin. Peter D'Amato has been growing carnivorous plants for nearly 40 years, and his nursery, California Carnivores, in Sebastopol, California, boasts the world's largest collection of carnivorous plants. D'Amato is the co-founder of the Bay Area Carnivorous Plant Society and lectures on the subject nationwide. He's the author of the newly revised The Savage Garden, Cultivating Carnivorous Plants. Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, Judith.
Well, I have to say, I was one of those kids that tried to grow a Venus flytrap and didn't do very well. But as I was reading your book, I realized there are a lot of reasons why I probably wasn't very good at it. They're actually really pretty interesting plants to try to take care of and to cultivate. Where are carnivorous plants found in the world?
Well, surprisingly, the United States and Canada has the widest variety of carnivorous plants in the world. They do grow virtually worldwide. There are tropical ones. They grow in Europe, Siberia. A lot of them are in Australia. But here in North America, it's the only place where the Venus flytrap grows. It's native down near Cape Fear, North Carolina. We have all of the American pitcher plants, Sarracenia. There's 8 species, most of them in the southeast, and numerous sub-varieties and hybrids. One species is found all the way north into Canada. Hmm. We have a wide variety of sundews, plants with sticky tentacles that curl up around insects. We also have butterworts, bladderworts, and on the west coast, the cousin of the American pitcher plant, the cobra plant, Darlingtonia. So we really have quite a wide variety.
I have to say I was really surprised because I think they do seem so exotic, and often when we think exotic, we think tropical. But what are the common elements of the habitats wherever they're growing that they're found?
Almost all carnivorous plants are found in very low-nutrient soils. Usually the soils are very sandy, but they can also have a lot of peat moss or sphagnum moss growing with them. In Wisconsin, for instance, it's sphagnum bogs where you'll find pitcher plants, sundews, even butterworts. The big belt of carnivorous plants in North America is roughly from southern New Jersey, the Pine Barrens, all the way down the coastal plain in the Carolinas, Georgia, Alabama, into the Gulf Coast. And most of these habitats are wet savannas, grasslands. Unfortunately, most of them are gone these days. We've drained so many of the wetlands that we only have about 5% of our carnivorous plants left. The soils have water usually running through them very slowly from a lot of rain. And all the nutrients are leached out by the slowly moving water, these boggy areas. And carnivorous plants have adapted to supplement the nutrients that they need by catching all these vitamin pills with legs and wings, bugs, insects, and even little animals occasionally. So their fabulous appearance comes from their having evolved to lure, catch, kill, and digest insects and other animals to supplement their growth.
I think that's a fascinating example of evolution, and we'll talk about what the actual mechanisms are. But when did carnivorous plants first become identified and classified?
Well, it was suspected when, in the late 1600s, the first governor of North Carolina, Arthur Dobbs, he brought mention to some botanists in Kew Botanical Gardens, which was just beginning in England, of this curious fly trap sensitive, he called it. And, of course, it was the Venus fly trap, which was very abundant around the Wilmington area. It was suspected that the plant was carnivorous, but most people back then just didn't believe it. Even Linnaeus, who started the binomial system of naming plants and animals with Latin names so everybody in the world would know what species were being talked about, he refused to believe that the God's law could have been reversed and that lowly plants could actually eat, you know, higher life forms. But it was Charles Darwin. Many people, you know, remember Charles Darwin, of course, for Origin of Species. However, he wrote Origin of Species in about 2 or 3 years to beat out his competitor Wallace, who was developing a very similar theory to his. He spent over 20 years on his 1875 book, Insectivorous Plants, proving that there were indeed plants that ate insects and animals. He was so fascinated, for instance, with sundews. They're small plants, usually, with sticky tentacles that catch insects and then wrap around them and slowly digest them. He actually wrote that he cared more about sundews than the origin of all the species of life on Earth. And his wife wrote in a letter that he told her he thought that sundews might be disguised animals. He found that they were more sensitive to taste and touch than any of the animal species that he studied.
Wow.
So it was Darwin who really proved this, and then it started to become very well accepted in the late 1800s.
Well, and they were really quite popular in the Victorian age, correct? How did that
Yes.
kind of fad come about?
Well, it was in the 1800s that, you know, the middle class and the upper class economies were booming in places like England as well as North America. And people started to build greenhouses, and they first started to use this to grow things like oranges. But then there were nurseries, particularly in England, like Hugh Lowe and Company and the famous Veitch dynasty, which existed for over a century. They were not only growing and producing trees and other plants for the estates of wealthy people. This is like the beginning of horticulture. But as glass houses were being developed, they started to send out expeditions to exotic places like Borneo and North America. And they would come back not only with orchids and palms and rhododendrons, but carnivorous plants, particularly tropical pitcher plants, the Nepenthes, which grow mostly in Southeast Asia. But they also, you know, introduced into cultivation Venus flytraps, American pitcher plants, and many others. And it was very, very popular among wealthy people to have these huge conservatories with all of these beautiful exotic tropical plants that they would heat with wood stoves. And Nepenthes in particular were very, very popular at the time.
But then World War I had a big impact on that because of scarcity of fuel and other necessities. What happened to all those collectors and collections of carnivorous plants?
Well, the collectors mostly survived. But yes, World War I, the Depression, World War II, virtually wiped out most of these exotic collections, including many carnivorous plants. There are some survivors from the Victorian age, both American pitcher plant hybrids and cultivars, as well as tropical pitcher plants. They mostly survived at universities and Kew Botanical Gardens. And the interest in the plants really didn't begin in earnest again until the 1970s. Japan started a society in 1948, but the International Carnivorous Plant Society, which was started here in North America, that didn't really begin until about 1972. And very gradually, interest in the hobby started to increase. Now it's booming worldwide. There are societies all over the world. The International Society has conventions about every year or two. The last one was actually in Boston last August, and it's gotten very, very popular. The internet has helped tremendously. And also having good information on the plants through books like mine, The Savage Garden, and our website and many other websites that exist now.
We are talking with Peter D'Amato. He's been growing carnivorous plants for nearly 40 years, and his nursery, California Carnivores, has the world's largest collection of carnivorous plants. Peter is the co-founder of the Bay Area Carnivorous Plant Society and lectures on that subject nationwide. He's the author of the newly revised version of The Savage Garden, Cultivating Carnivorous Plants. We'd love to have you join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question, comment, or photo of carnivorous plants on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mealer Show. Mealer is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R, and there are already some wonderful photos up there that we'll talk about in just a moment. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mealer. Jennifer Dargan, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network. I hope you'll stay tuned, because today at 11:45, we'll visit with Adam Schrager about his new book, The 16th Rail, The Evidence, The Scientist, and the Lindbergh Kidnapping. It has a fascinating Wisconsin connection. But right now, we're learning about the fascinating world of carnivorous plants from Peter D'Amato. He's the author of The Savage Garden, Cultivating Carnivorous Plants. And Peter, we do have quite a few comments on our Facebook page already. Carolyn in northern Minnesota says, "We have seen pitcher plants and sundew many times. They're bog-loving plants, and with the proliferation of insects, it's a target-rich environment. They get their nitrogen from their victims, especially essential for photosynthesis."
Yes, they require these insects to make up for the nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, you know, things that people would normally fertilize carnivorous plants with. And, of course, if you grow carnivorous plants, you don't want to add heavy-duty fertilizers into the soil or use rich soil for them. Usually we use sphagnum peat moss mixed with a little bit of perlite or washed horticultural sand, and allow them to catch their own insects. In a place like Wisconsin, I could give you some pointers on, let's say, how to grow a Venus flytrap. Because if you know how to grow a Venus flytrap, you could grow about 80% of the carnivorous plants that are in cultivation. Flytraps come from North Carolina, so they are temperate plants. They do experience frost and chill and even sometimes snow on the coast of Carolina, so the plants go dormant. However, they won't survive if they're outdoors in a pot in a really cold temperate climate like Wisconsin. But you should use sphagnum peat moss, which does not have any Miracle-Gro fertilizer added to it. Mix maybe 20% perlite, which is the white small rock that people often use for houseplants. And the plants require sunny conditions when they're in growth. Many people try to grow carnivorous plants like a flytrap on bright windowsills or in the shade outdoors. That just won't do it. Almost all carnivorous plants are sun lovers. In a place like Wisconsin, the plants will be dormant in the wintertime, and the coldest time should be Thanksgiving to Valentine's Day. Then you can move the plant to a sunny windowsill, or once the frosts are over, you can grow a Venus flytrap outdoors in a partly to very sunny area. The pots always have to sit in water. These are wetland plants, often coming from bogs, so the soil always has to be wet. Since they're sensitive to minerals in the soil, if you have hard water with a lot of minerals in it, avoid it. Use collected rainwater or purified reverse osmosis water from water vending machines or distilled water. Don't fertilize it in the soil. Most carnivorous plants really prefer insects. Some people will grow tropical plants in a terrarium, and rather than hassle with feeding them insects, then you could spray the foliage with a very diluted fertilizer. But fly traps usually begin their growth around March. They have their big summer traps up usually around April or May through September. Then, as the photo period starts to shorten, the plants start to lose their big summer traps, and they begin to get small as they prepare for winter. So if you're growing it outdoors, around October or before big freezes start, move the plant to a chilly or colder windowsill of your house. Basement windowsills can work, or partly heated porches where the plants will still get light, but they won't be kept at, like, you know, 70, 80 degrees all the time. Fly traps will survive freezes down into the 20s, even the teens, briefly. And frost is actually pretty good for them. If you are able to grow a fly trap like that, there's a lot of other plants like American pitcher plants and sundews, most of which really appreciate being outdoors in the wintertime. And one more thing for cold temperate areas like up in Wisconsin and New England and the Great Lakes, if you do a bog garden that is actually in the ground, usually in, with a pool liner, about maybe 1 foot to a foot and a half deep, and you fill it up with peat moss, you could grow a lot of even the southern carnivorous plants in this bog garden, because when they go dormant in winter, if you get a good snow covering, that will insulate them. Some people will put hay or burlap sacks over the bog, and even though the bog may freeze, the plants are often protected, and they could survive the winter outdoors.
And we have caller Aaron in Menominee, who also posted on our Facebook page some amazing photos of carnivorous plants, and he's been growing them in Wisconsin for about 10 years now. So let's see what Aaron has to add to that conversation. Hi, Aaron. Aaron?
Oh, yeah. Are you there?
Yes.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. So you've been growing carnivorous plants in Wisconsin for a long time.
Yeah, since... I'm originally from here, and I was away for a while during the college years. But yeah, since about 2003, I've been moved back here, and I've been growing pretty much just pitcher plants, Sarracenia, grow them outside.
And so the things that Peter was saying about his recommendations for growing things like Venus flytraps in Wisconsin, does that coincide with what you've learned over the years?
Yeah, I would say it. I mean, he's the expert.
Are you growing them in a bog garden, Aaron?
No, I originally would grow them all in individual pots, and they would be sitting in, you know, trays to keep standing water in them.
Yes.
But I've found that I would have some mortalities every winter. I keep them in my garage during the winter.
Right, yeah.
And I mean, some years they'd all survive, but there was a couple of years where I suffered some heavy losses.
Yeah, sometimes if they're in total darkness in the winter, since the soils still have to remain damp to wet, a lot of times mold and stuff can appear, you know. That's why I recommend something like windowsills if your garage has a windowsill.
It does have a small windowsill, but I also have some lights in there that I put in there to keep it from being dark.
Do you, are these grow lights?
I couldn't tell you what exactly kind they are or anything, but...
Yeah, a lot of people use fluorescent for the plants. And in the wintertime, the photo period should be reduced down to about 8 or 9 hours, you know, during the months of November, December, January.
I was going to say probably about 5 years ago, I started putting everything into larger tubs, probably about 8-10-gallon tubs.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I haven't lost a plant. And
yeah.
I'm assuming partly they're more protected from the cold because my garage is not heated. It's not insulated.
Right, exactly. That's also why bog gardens outdoors can often keep the plants alive during their dormancy.
Well, Aaron posted a link to a Flickr photo album online. He posted it on the Facebook page. And those are just amazing photos, Aaron. They're really spectacular pictures of your pitcher plants and all kinds of things. Over how much time did you take all those pictures?
Oh, basically, probably since I started
Wow. Well, they are really spectacular. I would encourage everyone to go to the Facebook page. And it's Aaron posted the link to the Flickr photo collection as a comment to the status talking about today's show with Peter D'Amato. So take a look at those. They are really spectacular pictures. And, you know, reading your book, Peter, it's clear that it's not the easiest kind of plant to grow anywhere. But it seems like it certainly has some great rewards to taking on the challenge.
Yeah, and a lot of it does depend on whether or not you have a greenhouse or if you live in the southeast. Many of our customers who live, let's say, on the west coast from Vancouver, Canada, all the way down to San Diego, or from eastern Texas through the southeast up to Atlanta, the Carolinas, even parts of New England, they find the plants very easy to grow if they're adaptable to their climate. You basically just keep them in pots or containers outdoors, always sitting in water in a sunny area. And the only thing you really have to do besides weed them and trim them is add water to the water trays. Other plants like tropical Nepenthe pitcher plants and some of the sundews that may come from tropical areas, they usually do best in greenhouses that are heated to at least 50 degrees in the wintertime. They also excel in terrariums under various types of grow lights, like LED lights that are becoming quite popular, or T5 and T8 fluorescent lights. If you decide to grow a Venus flytrap in a terrarium under grow lights, let's say a teacher who wants to have some carnivorous plants in a classroom, you can certainly do that. However, something like a Venus flytrap that's temperate should be removed from the terrarium sometime between Halloween and Thanksgiving, and then perhaps brought home, put on the chilliest windowsill of your house or a partly heated porch so it could go through its dormant period. And then by the middle or late February, you could put it back in the tank, and then it will slowly start to grow again, thinking that, you know, it's springtime.
We're talking with Peter D'Amato. He's the author of The Savage Garden, Cultivating Carnivorous Plants. It's a newly revised edition out right now. And his store, his nursery, California Carnivores, houses the world's largest collection of carnivorous plants. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Now, you were just talking about your nursery, and the Botanical Club of Wisconsin posted a photo of a carnivorous plant on the Facebook page, Peter, and said, "We have about 15 species of carnivorous plants native to Wisconsin, and many are easily observed in the wild. However, people should never take them from the wild to try and grow indoors. Only purchase plants from reputable sources." Would you like to add a little bit to that?
Oh, I definitely agree. Conservation of carnivorous plants is extremely critical since so many of them are disappearing. Another thing, virtually all carnivorous plants that people like to grow are in cultivation and they're being propagated like what our nursery does. We only sell plants that we have grown from seed or division or leaf cuttings or through tissue culture in test tubes. Removing plants from the wild is not very smart. Not only are you threatening established, you know, populations of the plants, but also they're very difficult to adjust to cultivation if they're dug up out of the wild. They often go through shock, for instance. In the olden days, you know, before the 1990s, when Venus flytraps were finally tissue cultured in laboratories, unfortunately, about 1 million Venus flytraps every year were being dug up out of North and South Carolina. There used to be so many plants down there, particularly in the Green Swamp, which was about 70 miles in diameter. There were areas where you couldn't help but step on flytraps. They just grew everywhere.
Wow.
But these wetlands, like the Green Swamp, were drained, and they drained them for wood pulp production. Growing pine trees and things. They would dig drainage ditches so that all the water would leave. And, of course, the fly traps and many other exotic orchids and other plants, including pitcher plants and sundews, would disappear. Now, you know, there are places like the Nature Conservancy that purchase land that has these plants on them. They protect them. They do controlled burns, which is very important to many plants in the wild. And just a few years ago, they purchased from Louisiana Pacific over 300,000 acres of what used to be the green swamp, with the intention of filling in the drainage ditches, letting all the pine trees die away, and reverting them, you know, back to the habitat that they were. But I don't recommend, you know, removing carnivorous plants from the wild.
We had a Facebook comment from Carol. She says, we've got a nice patch of sundew that grow wild on English Lake. It's growing on a spongy moss area up close to the lake. They're blooming right now. She says they're west of Mellon, Wisconsin, which is in the top, it's pretty far northern Wisconsin, closing in on the Lake Superior belt up there. So that's pretty far north, like those Canadian varieties that you were talking about.
Yeah, and there's a couple of species of sundews that grow up there in the Great Lakes area in southern Canada, and some of them are found, you know, further south. You have round-leaf sundews, Drosera rotundifolia, which is what Charles Darwin did his experiments in. You also have Drosera intermedia, which is a spoon-leaved sundew. A similar one is Drosera anglica. And there's also butterworts, Pinguicula vulgaris, which is a sticky flypaper-type plant. That grows there. And Sarracenia purpurea. The subspecies purpurea grows north of New Jersey through virtually the whole eastern half of Canada, always found in generally bogs or around the edges of lakes.
And you mentioned Borneo earlier, and I had a really amazing experience about 6 years ago going to Borneo and being able to hire a guide to take us hiking to be able to see pitcher plants growing in the wild. And I'll put some photos up of that later. Amazing pitcher plants, everything from little tiny ones that were hanging. It almost looked like those hot pepper light garlands that you see,
right,
like little,
yeah,
you know, vines with little pitchers hanging off of it, to pitchers that were literally bigger than a human hand. I mean, just huge, fleshy. It was amazing. I mean, to see them growing in the wild like that. And it was very sandy. You had to climb up, and it was not what anyone would consider great, rich soil. So that really fits in with what you were saying about what they like for a habitat.
Yes, even in the tropical places like Borneo, the Philippines, New Guinea, that's where the Nepenthes, the tropical pitcher plants, grow. They're completely unrelated to the American pitcher plants here in the United States and Canada. They're tropical vines, and 70% of them actually are mountain plants. They're found mostly from 3,000 all the way up as high as 8,000 feet down there in the tropics. So the temperature is often much cooler, particularly at nighttime. Temperatures, you know, around 6,000 feet will drop down into the 50s, and then during the day will be more like in the 70s and sometimes 80s. So a lot of the tropical pitcher plants can be very adaptable to room temperature. They really do best in larger terrariums with grow lights, but some people have sunrooms or rather sunny, humid windowsills, like on a bathroom, where you can grow Nepenthes. Nepenthes can get very large. There are vines that grow. They have pitchers that sit on the ground, and then the vines will climb up sometimes many meters in length with pitchers hanging in the air. Nepenthes are also the only genus of carnivorous plants, and there's several species that are now known to have caught animals as large as rats, devouring them all the way down to the bones.
Wow. We did actually have a caller who wondered what kinds of animals, as opposed to insects, that a plant can eat. Nancy was wondering, I guess, you know, are we talking mice? Are we talking rats? Are we talking, you know, small cats? What's the largest kind of animal that could be devoured by a carnivorous plant?
The largest that's ever been seen in the wild are rats.
Wow.
There's about 6 to 8 species now known. They have very large pitchers that can sometimes hold a couple of liters of fluid or almost a gallon of digestive juices. And these animals are usually caught accidentally. The plants primarily lure insects with nectar, and the insects get drugged and intoxicated, and then they fall into these pitcher fluids where they then are dissolved by the acids and enzymes, very much like an animal's stomach. And sometimes during drought times, or rats may want to be stealing some insects that the plant has caught, they'll fall in and they can't get out.
I guess if a plant has the ability to be surprised, that would probably be a pretty big surprise.
Yes, it would. And here in the United States, you know, sometimes Venus fly traps in the southeast will catch small anole lizards, or, you know, they also catch things like slugs occasionally. But it's definitely primarily insects that are caught, ants, flies, moths, things like that.
So to be considered a carnivorous plant, the plant needs to be able to lure its prey and to kill its prey and then to digest its prey. Are those kind of the main elements or defining elements of a carnivorous plant?
Yes, and even that's very controversial. There are thousands of plants that actually kill insects. Petunias have sticky hairs on their leaves, mostly to trap aphids and other pests from sucking their juices. Roadside teasels have leaves that form little cups that catch rainwater, and sometimes insects are found drowned in those little cups. The same is true with most bromeliad plants in the tropics. With carnivorous plants, they usually have to have some way of actually digesting their prey. And not all plants that are considered carnivorous actually produce acids and enzymes the way pitcher plants or fly traps do. There are actually some carnivorous plants that have other insects or spiders living on them. For instance, there's a plant called Roridula, which grows in South Africa. It's covered with very, very sticky tentacles that catch insects as large as bees. However, there's also assassin bugs that can walk right over these sticky tentacles without being trapped. They will suck the juices of the insects that are caught, and then they actually release their excrement and feces onto the plant, which is then absorbed by the plant just like a foliar fertilizer. So that's a symbiotic relationship, or digestion by proxy.
Hmm.
And there's a number of plants that do that.
Well, and right here in Madison, we had a Titan arum blooming just last week in the greenhouse. And certainly the Titan arum, first of all, looks like something just as otherworldly as, you know, Audrey 2 in the Little Shop of Horrors. But it's not a carnivorous plant. It does a very good job of attracting the flies with that smell of a rotting corpse. But the whole purpose is pollination. It's not for nutrition.
Exactly. Those are the carrion plants. And they really do have a terrible, vulgar odor of rotting flesh. And they do this to lure pollinators. And sometimes the pollinators themselves die in these flowers. However, the plant does not use them for nutrients. Yeah, you have to hold your nose when you...
Oh, but it's definitely worth a visit just to have that experience. And we've been lucky. We have one blooming here every few years, actually, in the greenhouses. Listener Bob in Eau Claire is on the line, so let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well.
Hi, Bob.
Good. I have seen many, many... In fact, I was a teacher administrator at a learning facility in northern Minnesota. And so we saw lots and lots of pitcher plants and sundews. And we pretty much had it figured out that they had to catch insects in order to get the nitrogen that they needed to be able to carry on photosynthesis. They were living in a nitrogen-poor environment. And I'm curious... a Venus flytrap. I'm not exactly sure what the habitat for that is, but does it also have a nitrogen deficiency, or is there some other reason that it's augmenting its dietary needs with flesh?
Sure. Peter?
All carnivorous plants are catching and eating insects and animals for that purpose, because they're in low-nutrient soils all the time. However, research has found that it isn't for photosynthesis. The plants can generally photosynthesize pretty much well on their own. Most of these minerals are used for propagation. It gives them the energy to flower and set seed. Flowering often has very, very taxing, it's very taxing on plants to flower. Many plants stop growing leaves when they're in flower. Sex takes up a lot of energy. And it's been found that when plants like Venus flytraps or pitcher plants or sundews, when they eat a lot of insects, they will produce many more flowers and seed in order to perpetuate their species. So it isn't, you know, just for photosynthesis, although, of course, having all these minerals certainly helps with that as well.
Thanks for that call, Bob. In just the couple minutes that we have left, Peter, is there one particular type or even more specifically a species of carnivorous plants that just really fascinates you and you just can't get enough of them?
Whatever one I happen to be looking at, and that's the truth. I grew up in New Jersey, and I tried growing fly traps when I was a kid in the 1960s that I ordered out of famous Monsters magazine. And, of course, they died. You know, the directions were very dismal. And then I found an article by Paul Zoll, 1961, in National Geographic magazine. I'm now friends with his daughter. His family often went on expeditions with him. And he had a marvelous article about carnivorous plants in the United States. And it blew my mind. I didn't know fly traps grew in the Carolinas and that we had so many species here. And then it was a classmate who showed me pitcher plants and sundews growing right there in the New Jersey Pine Barrens. I grew up on the Jersey Shore, and I've been hooked ever since. I'll never forget that very first day when I saw them in the wild. It just became imprinted in my brain. And actually, I still have descendants of purple pitcher plants that I've been growing since I was a teenager. And I'm approaching 60 years old now. So it shows that you can indeed grow carnivorous plants once you know how.
Well, Peter, I, for one, am very glad that you got hooked those many years ago and have spent so much time learning so much so you can teach the rest of us.
Thank you very much, Judith.
It's been a real pleasure. Peter D'Amato has been growing carnivorous plants, as he said, for nearly 40 years, and his nursery, California Carnivores, in Sebastopol, California, houses the world's largest collection of carnivorous plants. We have a link to that website on our Facebook page. It's californiacarnivores.com. You can visit that and revel in all those amazingly exotic and fascinating plants. It's really... There's so much to learn about them. And he's also the co-founder of the Bay Area Carnivorous Plant Society. And we're talking with him today in part because there's a new revised edition of his book, The Savage Garden, Cultivating Carnivorous Plants, available. So thanks so much to Peter D'Amato for being with us today. It's hard to imagine a more unique group of plants than carnivorous species, but even an ordinary tree growing in your own backyard, for example, is as unique as a human fingerprint. Coming up next, we're going to talk with Adam Schrager about his new book, The 16th Rail, The Evidence, The Scientist, and the Lindbergh Kidnapping. There's a fascinating Wisconsin connection, and wood science played a vital role in the trial of the century. It's a fascinating story, and it's coming up next right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.